You are listening to the Voice of Freedom radio program, your source for alternative information, always uncensored, often politically incorrect, and sometimes revisionist in nature. This is Ernst Zündel from the Voice of Freedom, coming to you from North America on the 19-meter band on 15.420 megahertz via WRNO radio every Sunday at this time. We have a very interesting guest for you today.
I am Ernst Zündel of the Voice of Freedom radio program. I have the pleasure to be talking to Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Radio. Mr. Weber, what exactly is your function and your title?
I'm the editor, Ernst, of the Journal of Historical Review, which we put out six times a year, and it's the main periodical of the IHR, which is probably the central clearinghouse for revisionist history in the United States, certainly, and probably in the world.
And the Institute was founded when and by whom?
The Institute was founded in 1978 in Southern California. At the very first meeting were scholars from around the world who had been working independently, including Robert Forison of France, Dr. Arthur Butz of the United States, Udo Valendi in Germany, and so forth. And independently, they had been working on the Holocaust issue and had independently come to the same conclusion that much of what we've heard about this issue is not really true. Through the IHR, these people came together at the very first meeting in 1979, and 1 year later, the IHR began its publication of its journal, which has been published since 1980 with the exception of 1 year, and that's how it began.
Now, why was it felt necessary to give such a kind of a is it a collection of brains, a forum? Whose idea was that, and was it patterned after some already existing establishment like institutes, or is it something totally new?
Well, it's both new and patterned after other groups. It's new in the sense that the IHR in a sense grew out of the Holocaust campaign that had reached a kind of new high, or really began in the late 1970s. You know, Ernst, it's interesting that many people who hear the term Holocaust all the time have the impression that it's been around forever. Well, it hasn't. It didn't really come into popular usage at all until the late 1970s, and into popular usage especially in 1978 when NBC broadcast a television miniseries of that name, which was very, very heavily promoted at the time. During the Second World War, or at the Nuremberg trials, or for years afterwards, no one really used or heard this term Holocaust. It's a kind of umbrella term that's been developed to cover a lot of really separate events, that is, the events surrounding the fate of European Jews during the Second World War. But the historical revisionists who have been questioning what we hear about the Holocaust really have been working ever since the end of the Second World War. But a serious effort to deal with this question from a skeptical or a revisionist point of view didn't really begin in earnest until the 1970s.
And who were the trailblazers of historical revisionism of the Holocaust as we know it?
The trailblazer, really, or the grandfather, you might say, of Holocaust revisionism was a Frenchman named Paul Rossignol, who, interestingly enough, was by conviction and so forth, a leftist. He was a member of the Socialist Party in France, and interestingly enough, was arrested by the German secret police, the Gestapo, in 1943 because of his resistance or anti-German activities in France. He was a member of an organization which, among other things, helped to smuggle Jews in France into Switzerland, from France into Switzerland. Paul Rossigny was certainly no fan of Nazi Germany, and he was, after his arrest, sent to and interned in the concentration camps at Dora and Buchenwald. But after he came back to France after the end of the war and was awarded the highest awards of the French government for his resistance activities and also served for a time in the French National Assembly, he was nevertheless very upset by stories that were in wide circulation about Buchenwald and the other concentration camps, because he had been there and he knew the situation. He wrote first a memoir about his experiences in the Buchenwald camp, and then he began dealing with the larger question of what really is the story with what we hear about the fate of the Jews in Europe during the Second World War. But Paul Rossigny inspired others to begin their own investigations, and one of those who was inspired was Dr. Robert Forison. And he's now almost unquestionably the leading European revisionist scholar. But he was inspired by Paul Rossigny, and so were others. But Holocaust revisionism has taken on the importance it has in recent years, largely because the Holocaust campaign itself has taken on such an enormous role in recent years. It's interesting, Ernst, that in contrast to virtually any other aspect of history, the emphasis in hammering away on the Holocaust theme has grown greater with the passage of time, not less. And I think that it's clear that the reasons for this have more to do with current political and social and economic realities than they do with history.
Now, the Institute is a collection of eggheads or what?
People ask very often, well, who's behind the IHR? Well, the Institute for Historical Review does have support from an impressive number of scholars and academics, people who, by any standard, are serious and conscientious historians and scholars. But in addition, the IHR has support from many people who are not scholars, but who are very interested in historical truth and who are very unhappy about the kind of sledgehammer propaganda we get, particularly with regard to the Holocaust issue. The IHR is funded really in two ways. First, we're funded by the sales of books and audio tapes and videotapes, which we sell all over the world, and through the subscriptions to our magazine. But also, we are very proud that we receive this financial support from individual contributors, most of them very modest contributions from people all over the world. Contrary to what sometimes is alleged, we don't have rich oil sheikhs or wealthy individuals bankrolling the IHR.
Yeah, I was going to come to that. You preempted my question. So there is no truth to the, no substance to the rumor that you are this well-heeled, well-financed juggernaut. What are the links, by the way, of the IHR to the Liberty Lobby? There's always in the media this link made. Is there a link?
The only link is that the man who was most instrumental in founding the IHR, Willis Cardo, is also the man who founded the Liberty Lobby. But the IHR and Liberty Lobby are completely independent and separate organizations. There are no organizational or financial links between the two. And in fact, I think pretty clearly and obviously to anyone who cares to pay attention to the Journal of Historic Review or the periodicals and material put out by the Liberty Lobby can see that the emphasis, the tone, and the content are really quite different.
Now, at your conferences, you certainly have an illustrious group of speakers over the years. You have even Japanese scholars, and you had Jewish people speak, like David Cole, for instance, at the last conference. What other avenues? You're not only concerned with Holocaust revisionism as such, you're also looking into Pearl Harbor, for instance, and other issues, right?
Right, that's right, Ernst. Then, for example, we're very proud that 1 year, our main conference speaker was the American historian John Toland, who received a Pulitzer Prize for his book The Rising Sun, which dealt with the war in Asia between the United States and Japan. He, as far as I know, has not expressed any particular view or support for the revisionist view on the Holocaust issue. In fact, he's rather skeptical of what Dr. Forrestone or Dr. Arthur Butts or so forth have said on this issue. But the IHR does not insist that those people who support it agree with everything that this person or that person might have to say. But so over the years, the IHR has dealt with many other issues besides the Holocaust issue. The cover story in the July-August issue of our journal deals, for example, with the great debate in the United States at the turn of the century over whether America should or should not become an imperialist power. And there was a great deal of discussion at that time, which I think has real relevance today because of the interest that recent American presidents have had in sending troops off to Bosnia and Macedonia and God knows where. And at the turn of the century, there was a great discussion about whether the United States should make a colony out of the Philippines, or whether we should acquire Puerto Rico, and what that meant, whether the United States should become an imperial power like Britain and France and Germany at the time. But anyway, that's the cover story of the July-August issue.
So when judges in my court case, for instance, and in other court cases and media, people accuse you of being some kind of a rightist or fascist think tank, that is not entirely true.
No, that's not true at all. The IHR is very proud and very pleased that over the years we've received the support of people of every possible political orientation and a wide range of ethnic and racial and religious backgrounds. And if there's any consistent theme to the articles and the books the IHR has published, it's the earnest wish for international understanding as a foundation for peace and for at least tolerable relations between nations and peoples. The IHR specifically holds as a kind of model the writings and work of American scholars like Harry Elmer Barnes. Now, Harry Elmer Barnes was by no stretch of the imagination a rightist, and the IHR is pleased that it's published quite a lot of his writing over the years. He had enormous influence on American historiography and sociology during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And consistent with that, the IHR has taken stands and has presented information which cannot be classified as either right or left.
Does an issue have to be old, 10 years old, 20 years old, 50 years old, 100 years old, before the IHR delves into it? Or do you also deal with current affairs?
Well, we like to look at things from a more distant view after the sort of dust is settled. Nevertheless, the IHR has dealt, for example, with the Israel-Palestine issue. And this is something that has its historical roots way back in time, but it's something that's still going on and is very relevant today. The criteria we really use, Ernst, is whether historical questions are of relevance and importance today. And the historical background of the Israel-Palestine issues, I think, unquestionably of real importance and relevance today. And people ask us, well, why do you keep on talking, for example, about the Holocaust issue? Well, the reason we deal with this as much as we do isn't because we're just fascinated with Zyklon B, or we're fascinated with the chemical properties of this or that, or we're fascinated with concentration camps. It's because this particular chapter of history has become unquestionably the most politicized, the most propagandized chapter of history in our society today. I think that, as a number of even prominent Jewish writers have emphasized, it's become almost a kind of substitute religion in our society, so that people of many different political viewpoints cite the Holocaust as a moral compass for their arguments on this or that particular issue. For example, people on both sides, you might say the abortion issue, will talk about the Holocaust to justify their position. And in the United States, where, and in the Western world, in fact, where traditional religious beliefs seem to be on the decrease or on the wane, the Holocaust has been served up as a kind of substitute religion or a substitute moral compass. I think that's very dangerous for a lot of reasons we could go into. But anyway, there's no question but that this issue has become a very important one in our society.
If you pursue the point you just raised, where does that, if it is in effect a substitute religion, where does that kind of take us in the teaching of Holocaust curriculum in high schools and universities?
Well, the effort, and it's a very, very well organized and well funded effort, to inject what they call Holocaust studies into high schools and universities, and even into our government and into the U.S. military in the United States and in other countries, is part and parcel of this campaign. I think ultimately it really can't be successful, because the Holocaust campaign is of really personal and wrenching importance, really for Jews in the United States and around the world. And Jewish organizations have made an enormous effort to stress that. But I don't think that the Holocaust issue will ever really successfully be any kind of religious focus for non-Jews, because it doesn't have the same kind of impact. It doesn't have any real transcendental importance, I think, for all of humanity. In fact, one of the most, I think, reprehensible things about the Holocaust campaign is its implicit contempt for humanity. Over and over, one of the so-called lessons of the Holocaust is that all non-Jews bear a kind of collective guilt for what's regarded as the greatest crime in history, that is, the killing of 6 million Jews. And even people in the United States or in other countries are held to have been at least passive accomplices in this great crime. Well, that's a pretty perverse way of looking at humanity, and a pretty perverse way, I think, of looking at history. And for that, that's one of the reasons why I don't think we'll ever be successful there will never really be success in the effort to make it a kind of substitute religion.
How about this kind of aspect of morbidity, you know, when it comes to constantly showing cadavers and bulldozing bodies and emaciated bodies, and it is almost like a cult of death?
Yes. Well, one Jewish writer recently was making this point. He said, how does viewing pictures of dead people make anyone a better human being? One of the points that those people behind the Holocaust campaign try to make is that by hearing all of this, the world will supposedly never make it happen again. But I think that one could at least argue plausibly that that a great danger exists, that in fact it creates a kind of precedent. It says that, well, once one decides that this people or that people is your enemy, that the end result is that they all are exterminated, which I think is terrible.
So do you think that the Serbs in former Yugoslavia and any other warlord, even in Kampuchea or somewhere, feel that there was a formula that somebody allegedly once dreamed up, the industrial the industrialized almost murder of your enemies, that this then is a precedent for them. Is that what you're saying? The danger is?
I'm not saying that anyone is necessarily doing that right now. I'm just saying it creates a very dangerous thing. You know, it's part and parcel, I think, of the kind of dehumanization that's taking place in our culture. Everyone knows, gosh, that on television and motion pictures, we can see all sorts of terrible killing and violence and so forth. The Holocaust, almost to have an impact, the Holocaust campaign to have an impact, has to compete with that kind of cult of death. I think it's a very dehumanizing thing. I think it's a very terrible thing. It makes people overall think that getting into wars is a lot more easy, I think. It's really terrible how I think so many Americans, without giving much thought to it, were willing to rush off into this war against Iraq, and on the basis, in part, of propaganda, which we now know to have been a lie, know to have been untrue. One of the purposes and the importance, I think, of the work of the IHR is to learn the lessons of history. I mean, I know that sounds like what the people behind the Holocaust campaign are saying, but one of the lessons is to be very careful, to be very cautious and skeptical about war propaganda of any kind, and to be cautious about before rushing off into this conflict or that, and to look back and to say, well, is the world really a better place for having the United States, for example, gone off into the First World War? You know, in the aftermath of the First World War, for example, most Americans were pretty disgusted by the whole thing, because there was an enormous disillusionment that set in after the war was over, because so much of the propaganda of the war turned out to be false, and more than that, the stated goals of the war, that is to save the world for democracy, were and proved entirely elusive, never came about. And people should ask themselves likewise about many other wars that the United States and other countries have gotten involved in.
Now, you said that you also covered the Palestinian-Israeli issue. How often do Israelis, from the top government leaders down, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, and so on, invoke the Holocaust in order to justify some of their horrific policies towards the people that now they lord it over in Palestine?
Yeah, I think, Ernst, you're touching on something that's very important, and a number of even Jewish writers have spoken and written with some disgust about the way in which the Holocaust is invoked to justify policies by the Israeli government that would normally not be justifiable or not excusable. It's as if to say, well, because we've been so put upon, we have some right and justification for doing things that normally would be impermissible and would be condemned. There's no question, and this is something that is pretty widely acknowledged, but that the Holocaust campaign has become a kind of political football in our world, and
so
the State of Israel has used it. Israeli officials, especially Shamir and Begin, have used it to justify policies and actions.
I was just going to say, has it not, in effect, destroyed or certainly warped the vision of, let's say, Theodor Herzl for the State of Israel?
Yes. Well, Theodor Herzl, the founder of the modern Zionist movement, hoped that by creating a homeland and a state for the Jewish people, that this would end the age-old thing called the Jewish problem or the Jewish question, and that is, the Jews, by having a country of their own, would be a quote normal people. They wouldn't live as a people among other people, and with all of the conflicts and the problems that result from this kind of relationship. But it hasn't worked out that way, as you well know, as the world knows. I applaud at least some of the statements that have been made recently by the new Israeli Prime Minister Rabin, in which he stressed that we have to, that is the Jews, have to regard themselves as a people among other peoples. We can't, it's crazy over the long run to view the world as made up of potential murderous Nazis, and the only way that people can really get along is by trying to learn from the past, but at the same time, putting the hatreds of the past behind us, and to try to transcend that.
Now, we are winding down time-wise, but I still want to touch upon the influence that you think the Jewish religion has on this kind of ghetto thinking. In other words, seeing the me versus the rest of the world, or us versus them, that this basically connotes. Whenever you see problems in Israel, there is some pretty contrasty painting going on into black and whites.
Well, this is a complicated thing, Ernest, but the Jewish religion is unlike most other religions. It's not, unlike Christianity or Islam, it's not a universal religion. It's a religion for the Jewish people. Some Jewish writers have said it's the last tribal religion. It's a holdout of what religions were in a very long ago time. The judgment of whether a person is a good Jew isn't whether he abides by certain moral principles, as most other religions have it. It's rather whether he helps the Jewish people. And this is a very odd kind of thing. It's an unusual religion for that reason. It's not a transcendent religion. It doesn't attempt to proselytize. It's interesting that the in Christianity, the dates of the Christian calendar are dates in the life of Jesus Christ, the central figure. The dates in the Jewish calendar are dates in Jewish history, usually dates of great catastrophe of one kind or another, such as Passover, in which God supposedly killed the firstborn of Egypt and passed over the firstborn of the Jewish people of Egypt. But implicit in all of this is a view that the Jewish people are in a kind of constant conflict and turmoil in relationship to all other peoples. That's a very unusual thing. And the Holocaust campaign has come to play increasingly an important role for the Jewish people as part of the religion. And it fits in for many Jews along with things like Purim and Passover and so forth.
So is it a fact that this event is necessary for a modern self-definition of Jewry?
This point's been made by a number of Jewish writers. Michael Wolfson, who is a Israeli-born Jewish professor who teaches at a university in Germany, wrote a book on this very subject, and he said that the Holocaust has come to serve as a kind of cement or a glue for the Jewish people, because religious belief among most Jews, just as religious belief among many non-Jews, seems to be receding in recent years. The Holocaust has serves as a kind of new glue. It contributes to what he calls the we feeling of the Jewish people, and this point's been made especially for Jews in outside of Israel, where traditional Jewish religious bonds have weakened in recent years, so that it's in Jewish newspapers and Jewish leaders constantly invoke the Holocaust as the main focus and importance for the Jewish people.
We are coming to the end of our time. I wonder if you would give our listeners the address of the Institute for Historical Review.
Yeah, we certainly welcome letters and subscribers and so forth. Our address is Post Office Box 2739, Newport Beach, California, 92659, United States of America.
Very good. Well, I have enjoyed our interview. You were a witness in my very own trial here in Toronto, and I want to say thank you very much for your efforts that you're putting in on behalf of historical truth and freedom.
Thank you very much, Ernie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.